All right. At this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify. Requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday Night Speakers Meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety and attendance at a group conscious meeting, and I do have that year of continuous sobriety. Like I always say, by the grace of God in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and my higher power, and I am grateful to be here tonight. My name is Liz, and I'm an alcoholic. And again, I say this, I drink alcoholically from the beginning, and you know, like what Kim read today, more about alcoholism, I tried everything to quit. I did everything in my power to quit on my own, and I wasn't able to when I wanted to. You know, that mental obsession was so great in my mind that alcohol controlled me. I had no control over alcohol. And that's when I had to admit that I was powerless over it, and my life had become manageable. And that's the first step to this program. And you know, I came in these rooms, and I surrendered, and I got a sponsor, and read the book, which I highly recommend, and worked the steps with the sponsor. And for one day at a time, I haven't had to take a drink for a little bit of time here. And, you know, I'm one of those that's not a one-hit wonder. You know, I have quite a few white chips. From the beginning, I didn't get sober early on. Then I did get sober for a period of time, and then I quit doing the deal. You know, it's amazing. You know, you got to keep doing this thing every day. I was sitting there thinking the other day, like, oh, do I have to do this every day? And it's like, yeah, you know, this is who I am, first and foremost. My son tonight didn't want me to come here, but I have to come here because, you know, this is what makes me a better parent, a better wife, a better friend, a better daughter, a better employee, a better everything, you know. And, you know, it's through this program and you guys that I've learned how to be a member, productive member of society. And I'm really grateful to be here. So that's enough out of me. And I'm going to introduce our speaker tonight. And one of the benefits of coming in here and staying here for a little bit of time is that you get to see people come in and get sober and get the seal. And, you know, I do sponsor women, and but at the same time, coming to meetings, I come to regular meetings regularly, and I see people that come in and surrender and come to meetings. And then I watch this guy come in, surrender, kind of kicking and screaming a little bit at the beginning, and then, you know, decide to do the deal. And, you know, he's jumped into AAA and stuck himself in the middle of it. And let me tell you, that's what you got to do. You got to just stick yourself right in the middle of this place. And it, you know, I've seen his life change before my eyes. And even though I don't know him that greatly, I know him enough and watched him in the rooms. And I've admired watching that. And it's been a pleasure to watch him. So I want to hear a story tonight. So I'm going to introduce Jonathan for you.
Hello, everyone. My name's Jonathan. I'm an alcoholic. I got here tonight and was a bit on the nervous side, not too nervous. Went straight into the bathroom, got on my knees, and started praying, and you know, realized it was actually the second time in the past almost year and a half that that I was on my knees in front of a toilet and was not throwing up, and it wasn't due to drinking too much. And I do thank God for that. My sobriety date is May 18th, 2009. So I have 14 months of sobriety. In the grand scheme of things, it's not too much. For me, though, that just it goes to prove that there is a God. I would not be able to stand here in front of you if God was not there looking out for me. And it took me quite some time. It took me 32 years to be able to actually, you know, realize that, to open my mind. And, you know, sobriety is my problem. I couldn't stand being sober, and that's why I drank and did everything that I did over those years. And, you know, to understand where the problem started, I'll back up from the, you know, and from the beginning when I was growing up, I never felt like I fit in. It's something you hear and hear all the time. I was the victim for many school days where I was, you know, picked on all the time, and I never felt a part of. I always was on the outside, and you know, my parents started recognizing that when I didn't want to go to school, and so, you know, that, and I'm not here to psychoanalyze my childhood, but, you know, the important fact about that, what ended up happening was my father at a small age would sit me down and have man-to-man talks. the man-to-man talks always included him pouring a little bit of his beer into a glass so he could sit down. And you know, at a very young age, I came to the conclusion that, you know, drinking beer was the adult thing to do. Drinking if I was having a hard time with things, you know, was the way to go. And you know, in no way, shape, or in no way do I actually blame my parents for my alcoholism. It's because I poured enough alcohol inside my mouth to become an alcoholic. But at a young age, I kind of recognized that drinking was a way to help me cope. And it worked, and you know, I felt cool that he was sharing it with me, and you know, but anyways, that was how I first, you know, had my first alcoholic beverage. In the fourth grade, I was taken out of school to be taught at home because the kids were still relentless with me. Went back to school in the sixth grade, public school. I was taught at home for the period of time between the fourth and the sixth grade. Going back to school, I was the new kid again. I never, you know, in those early childhood years, never felt a part of. You know, my skin never fit. Things just, you know, I thought I was unique. I thought I was different. You know, poor me. And so, you know, that's basically my childhood in a nutshell. And you know, one of the amazing things when I was a kid growing up, I was one of the lucky ones to have a full bar in my basement, fully stocked with liquor, kegerator, you know, you name it, my parents had it downstairs. We were the entertainers of the family. We had the parties, and so it was always easily accessible for me to be able to go when I had friends over to go and sneak some drinks and you know, and it was exciting for me. It was you know, it was something that I thought was cool. It's what the adults do, and you know, and just like most people, it's not original. That's just how I really got started with everything. You know, it didn't really become a problem until my teen years. I grew up in a small town in Massachusetts, and in this town there wasn't much going on. Finally got a car, driving around, and basically it was a mobile party. We would drink and drive, and you know, and that's pretty much all there was to do that. And you know, and we made a few attempts at cow tipping, but that never worked because we were too messed up and got scared once we got close to the cows. You know, it pretty much that sums up my childhood. And in my teen years, when I was really discovering what it was like to drink, and have the effects of alcohol, something definitely clicked. Where, you know, I started off and it was cool. It's what the adults did, and then in my teen years, it's what we did to have fun, and that's what we did. No matter what it was that we did, wherever we were going, whatever we were doing, there was always drinking involved. It was not difficult to get alcohol at a young age. I had cool uncles who would actually buy us alcohol, friends who had older brothers who would buy us alcohol, and you know, it's whatever we did, it just involved the drink. You know, in my later teen years, you know, the whole not fitting in, being different, being uncomfortable, my skin not fitting, you know, alcohol fixed that. It fixed that when I was trying to talk to the girls. It gave me, you know, the liquid courage, and it really, you know, it gave me this false pride that you know, lasted for a few hours, and then I'd get completely obliterated and make a fool out of myself, and then people would make fun of me the next day. You know, where slowly but surely things started progressing. My later teen years, going to college, that's when I moved out of my parents' house, moved in with a friend of mine who actually came into these rooms back last May with me. And we moved in together. We wanted to have a little fun, go to school, and that's where the parties on a daily basis really started. You know, there was actually a point in time when this kid literally attempted to hit me with a frying pan, because we were just all wasted, and I forget the exact reason why, but, you know, things just started getting messy. And that's, when, you know, the blackout started. I turned into a blackout drinker in my early 20s. Didn't think it was a problem. You know, in the first reading where it said, you know, how we try to, you know, try to drink like other people, I had resigned to the fact that I don't drink like other people. What I wanted to do was to get everybody else to drink like me when I was drinking. You know, I was always the one that was buying the shots for everyone. I was always the one making sure their cups were filled. You know, and I looked at myself as being a nice guy. You know, I was looking out for them, and little did I know, so, you know, as time progressed in my 20s, things, you know, just the alcoholism progressed. I didn't think it was a problem. I thought it was perfectly normal. You know, my uncles, my father, my family, they all partied like I was partying now. And the blackouts became more frequent. Things, you know, just a lot of stuff just started happening, and I looked at it as bad luck. It was, you know, it was all just bad luck. When I was 22, I was out with some friends and went over to a friend's house, and we'd been drinking all night long. And they didn't want me to leave. I wanted to go home. They told me that I needed to stay over, and so I slept there for, I think, probably 2 or 3 hours. Driving home, I had made a little detour just to go and see an old place that I was living at. And when I came to a stop sign, I didn't come to a complete stop. And as I was creeping out into the intersection, A University of Massachusetts state police officer happened to be driving by and came to a screeching halt, thinking that I was going to be hitting him. And you know, I got pulled over, and you know, it was unavoidable. I got arrested for driving under the influence of alcohol. I refused a breathalyzer, and you know, and then started in this whole process of having to deal with the situation that I got myself into. When this happened, the only thing that the state, you know, the state took my license away, they made me go to 3 AA meetings. And so, you know, I wasn't smart enough to realize, you know, that you can kind of get away with things if you're forced to go to AA meetings. And so I went to those 3 AA meetings. I thought all of you guys were absolutely crazy. I thought it was a cult. I saw the word God and people talking about God, and I just wanted absolutely nothing to do with it. But lucky for me, I had convinced myself that drinking was not a problem, that what I was doing was absolutely perfectly normal. You know, sometimes I drink too much, sometimes I don't drink too much. You know, everybody has their moments, and so, you know, I spent the thousands of dollars. I had lost my license for a while, and everything pretty much cleaned itself up, and then I was off to the races again, it's very strange because, you know, looking back on it now, I hadn't realized what had actually happened because of the arrest. So I got arrested. I was a full-time musician, part-time pizza delivery boy. Couldn't work anymore because I was delivering pizzas. So my father sat me down, had a man-to-man talk, which did not include alcohol at this point in time. He was smarter than that. And you know, they started catching on, but luckily I was able to convince them that it wasn't that big of a deal. I was you know, just in the wrong place at the wrong time. But you know, my father sat me down, had that talk, and so what ended up coming from that talk was a career. So I got arrested, and then a door opened up for me because of that to go into advertising sales. And so he took me under his wing, and you know, and for years after the arrest. You know, I look back now, and it's like, you know, the part that separates the problem drinker from the alcoholic is, you know, like, being an alcoholic, thinking about it, it's like, why did I have to take that detour? If I didn't take that detour, I wouldn't have been in that spot. and I wouldn't have gotten arrested, and all this crap that happened, you know, wouldn't have happened. I think a problem drinker would probably end up realizing that driving after drinking all night isn't that great of an idea. And so, you know, just more evidence that I am an alcoholic. So I get the job, things start going well. You know, I'm in this band, and things are going well with the band, and you know, and it's just easy access to more alcohol. Start playing the shows out, get the VIP treatment, the free drinks. You know, just so many times that I made a complete fool out of myself. What started happening, though, was the insecurities from my childhood started creeping back in, where I didn't feel a part of, I didn't feel good enough. And you know, but things kept going, and I didn't feel like I was nearly as good as everybody else that was actually in the band. And so, you know, I got the girl, have the job, have this band, trying to balance everything together, and it was just, you know, and then of course had my true love alcohol, which took up a majority of the time. And so I had to let one of those things go. I couldn't let the job go, and I thought it was the love of my life. I couldn't let her go. And so I decided I was going to let the band go. And so, you know, sitting down with four other guys in our 20s and telling them that I just can't do it anymore. I've got to focus on the career. I've got to focus on the girl. And, you know, these you know, five guys sitting around in the rehearsal studio, you know, all of us crying. And, you know, and looking back on it now, they were upset because they wanted me in the band. But the entire time I felt like they didn't want me in the band. And, you know, and I've heard Sandy Beach say, you know, that you can change your past at any point in time. There was a particular story that he was talking about, and you know, about his past, where he thought that people just were ashamed, like ashamed of him, and didn't accept him when the truth was that they were really sad to see him go. And it's the same exact thing that, you know, now looking back on it, I realize I had a great thing and I gave it up because I was so insecure and didn't feel like I deserved it. And so, you know, with the job and the girl, things were going all right with those two aspects of my life. My drinking was progressing and progressing and progressing. And one night, the girl was out of town, and so I had free reign of the town. And I had gone to a bar directly after work. We had a bar on the very first floor of our office building, which was quite convenient for me. So I went there with some friends after work, you know, drank too much, went home, was home for probably 5 minutes, decided that I was going to go to another bar. Go to this other bar that I hadn't ever been to. I'd been to some of its neighbor bars down the street. And so I'm sitting there, you know, already completely wasted when I walk in, and all I remember is the first drink. I remember sitting there, and there's this band playing in the corner acoustically, and sitting right next to them clapping and probably making a complete fool out of myself. That's all I remember. The next day I woke up at 11 o'clock in the morning on my couch, halfway on my couch with my work clothes on from the day before, already several hours late for work. And, you know, my boss actually had to report to my father. And so it didn't look good. It didn't look good at all. So I called him, told him I had overslept, was going to make it in a little while. So I went, got ready for work, grabbed my keys, ran out behind the house that I was living in where the parking lot was, and my car was not there. I had no idea what had happened. No idea at all. And so finally I end up taking a cab over to the bar that I was at, and my car is parked right in front of it. And, you know, not knowing what happened, how I got home, I didn't have any charges on my credit card. I don't, there's no, like, nothing to trace how I got home, what I had actually done. They didn't charge me for that one drink. I don't know what happened. It was the scariest moment in my drinking up to that day, where I knew that this was serious. So got my car, finally make it into work, and go into my boss's office, sit down, start crying, and tell him that I think I might be an alcoholic. And the only reason I was trying to do that was to get pity and to be able to get away with what I had done. And so, of course, my father gets involved. He sets up an appointment for a drug and alcohol counselor for me. Go to the drug and alcohol counselor, like, the next day. Next day, sitting there, and I'm just trying to convince her beyond belief that it's really not a problem. I just had a little too much to drink that night. And sure enough, you know, just back to the races, like everything was normal. So a little while after that, got a promotion at work. The stress rose. My drinking ended up increasing. Everything started to get a bit chaotic. And the girl decided one day that she was going to leave me. The girl leaves me, and the only thing that I remember from that conversation, what she said to me, was, "I am sick and tired of you being that guy." And I was appalled. Like, what are you talking about? Every time we go anywhere that there is drinking, you are always that guy. And I had no idea what she was talking about. Little did I know that she knew more about me than I knew about myself at that time. And so the girl leaves, and, like in the reading, a few months later, depressed, drinking out of control, drugs really start becoming a big part of my life. And so I come up with the great idea that, you know what, if I didn't have the friends that I had, and if everything I saw didn't remind me of this girl, then I wouldn't be drinking like this. So geographical relocation, here I come. So I make the decision to move down to Florida, come down here, had everything lined up with a brand new job, come down here. This was back in February of 2005, end of February, beginning of March 2005. And man, that geographical relocation really does not work. It did nothing but get worse. I didn't have to worry about my father catching on because he wasn't in the same office as me. I didn't have to worry about my direct boss telling my father that I smell like a bar. I didn't have to worry about being late because I was hungover. I didn't have to worry about any of the stuff that I had to worry about before. The drinking started to get completely out of control. I moved away from everybody. I came down here not knowing a single person. My best friend when I moved down here was a bottle of rum. And it stayed a bottle of rum for quite some time. You know, moving down here to get away from the people that drink like me, the amazing thing is that I end up moving into an apartment building filled with people that drink like me. And it just got to be chaotic, absolutely chaotic. So after a few years of putting up with the hangovers and, you know, the amazing thing being in an outside sales position is I could drink all night long, write it off on my taxes, come to work the next day, go home at about 10 o'clock in the morning and sleep for half of the day, come back to work for a couple hours, pretend like I've been working all day, and then go back out and do it all over again. And that's what my life had become. Like it says in what the doctor's opinion and in Bill's story, the night before a very important meeting with one of my clients that my boss and his boss were supposed to attend, everything was going to work out favorably. And then somehow I started drinking the night before with my coworkers. I had two beers with them. Went home, had a bottle of vodka, started pounding that. Woke up the next day, did the same thing, went into work for a couple hours, went home, couldn't get to sleep to try to sleep off the hangover for a little while. And so driving back to work, I knew I could not go to this meeting. I was feeling terrible. So I called into work, and the poor me thing starts again. I think I've got a problem, talking to my the HR person in the office and telling her, you know, asking her to talk to my boss to say that I'm sick, I can't make it in for the meeting. and that I think I need help because life is getting out of control. So I go and do that, and my boss calls me up like 5 minutes later. And so, I had gone drinking with my boss quite a few times. I'd actually gone out one night drinking with him, and he went home. I ended up in an ambulance. I had known him. He was a party animal. We had lots of fun together. The whole staff did. So my boss calls me after talking to my HR person, says, come to the office. I want to see you. I want to see you now. I'll meet you in the parking lot. So I go, bawling my eyes out, beat up pretty good. And so I hop into his car and tell him, I just can't handle life. It's so stressful. Poor me. If I wasn't in this situation, if this girl didn't break my heart, then, it wouldn't be this bad. I can't believe it. Blah, 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 blah. So he takes me to his house and pulls out this little, you might be an alcoholic if card. My boss was in recovery. So he gives me this card, and so I'm looking through it, and crying still, and I just remember looking at him and saying, I could check off every single one of these boxes. Oh my God. I'm such an idiot. Oh God. And so he gives me a big book. Gives me a schedule and says, you need to go to a meeting. And so it's like, okay, I will. And so, I get the rest of the day off so I can sleep off my hangover, feel great, come to a meeting. See step two up there. It's like, not for me. Power greater than myself, I thought I was it. So I was in here, I remember it was a 6 o'clock, I think it was a 12 and 12. Meeting, and I was sitting like right in the center over here, and got a white chip afterwards. People came up to me. Everybody was really nice and friendly, and I just thought you guys were so whacked. And I was an atheist, and I thought I was so smart I could disprove the theory of God. There's dinosaurs. That's not in the Bible. It's contempt prior to investigation. That's all it is. I was just in full flight from reality, so they say. So I went to that one meeting, figured, it's not for me because I'm not one of those religious types. And I stayed sober for probably about a week, maybe a week and a half or so. And look, I don't have a problem. I can go without drinking for a week. And then it started with the controlled drinking, which worked for probably a day. And then it was off to the races. And I tell you, it took one meeting for you guys to completely ruin my drinking. One meeting. The next 2 years, I was drinking for the sickest effect of all. I was drinking for complete oblivion. I was drinking. I was too chicken to put a knife to my wrist or to pop a bunch of pills. I was drinking and slowly trying to kill myself without even realizing it. I was so miserable. And it was blackout every night. I'd wake up on my couch. My couch still has an indent in the middle because that's where I'd sleep. I would think I couldn't sleep in my bed because that would remind me of my ex-girlfriend. And just this craziness that was going on. I could go out with friends after work, drink normally, but then little did they know, once everybody left, I went to the bar next door, got a few more drinks, then went home, stopped at the liquor store, and drank a bottle to my head. And every single night, I passed out. I blacked out every single night. I don't remember going to sleep for almost 2 years. And I'd wake up with a half full drink of whatever it was that I bought the night before. I've heard people say how they hide bottles from their spouses, where they're hiding them all over the house and trying to sneak it. I was insane enough where I would actually wrap up bottles in tin foil to try to get myself to stop drinking it because I knew I had to go to work the next day. I would wrap it up in tinfoil, and like 10 minutes later, I was peeling the tinfoil off, making a drink, just to try to remind myself that I can't drink anymore. I just couldn't stop. There was nothing, you know, there was no mental defense for me against alcohol. None whatsoever. That leads me to, it would be the 15th of May, 2009, my last spree. I'll never forget it. It started off with shotgunning natural lights at my friend's house. Right after work, which ended up being a pool party at my house, which ended up me, I almost got into a fist fight for the first time. I have never been in a fight, like except for one time when I was trying to break up a fight. I almost beat up my 19-year-old brother. Luckily, my friend was there who actually got in between the two of us. I punched a wall for the first time drinking, and damn, that wall won. My hand was killing me for weeks after that. So the next day, and this was at 6 o'clock in the morning. This was actually the first time the cops had ever showed up in my house here in the state of Florida as well. I slept for a few hours, woke up. My brother's on the phone with my parents, you know, sobbing. And so he hands me the phone, and my father found out. He found out what I was doing. And, oh, God. And, you know, and it didn't stop me. It didn't stop me that day. So Saturday, had to go to a work obligation which involved drinking, was up all day Saturday drinking, passed out at some point in time that Saturday night. My friends actually took the bottle of vodka that I was drinking away from me and hid it on me so that I wouldn't drink anymore. Woke up the next morning, found it, started drinking again, passed out. So it would be the 17th of May last year, passed out in my backyard, woke up to rain coming down on my face because my head was leaning back. Went straight to bed. It was probably about 7 o'clock at night. And the next morning I woke up for work, and I was shaking like I've never shook before. My hand was killing me. I went into work. I had been beaten severely by alcohol. The day started, and I have to, you know, write down a few different reports. I actually have to write them down with a pen. And I ended up having to go to my ad coordinator and tell her that, or ask her to actually fill out this report for me because I couldn't do it because I was shaking so bad. My father called me later on in the morning and talked to him. He had called the hospital, had called this outpatient program, and basically did an intervention over the phone. Said, you know, they didn't give me any sort of like, you know, if you don't do this, we're not going to talk to you ever again. But they didn't realize what I was doing. So I went back to the office, sat down in front of my boss, knowing now that he's in recovery. And I remember sitting down, and I'll never forget what I said to him, which I sat down and, you know, quivering and shaking beyond belief, and told him that I'm sick and tired of hating myself. I can't live like this anymore. And went straight to the hospital. Best damn thing that's ever happened to me. Best damn thing that's ever happened to me. I remember it like it was yesterday. Go to the emergency room. End up, going in, and I had to fill out this form on what my ailments were, and the only thing I could think of to put down there was my head. And so, you know, my head was my ailment. And so, of course, a woman comes walking over to me, and she's like, "What are you talking about, your head?" And I went up to her. Well, I looked up at her, and I just, like, I was, like, starting to ball up. I was like, and she just knew. She knew. So they brought me in, and bam, signed my rights away, and then was thinking to myself, what the hell did I just do? I do not have control of myself. This is the biggest mistake of my life. So I end up in South Seminole for 3 days. Get out, work wouldn't let me come back to work, start up in this intensive outpatient program. some amazing stuff started happening. My head, just after a couple days, you know, I was convinced, and I was able to survive on willpower for a few days. Willpower and the threat that my job was going to be taken away from me. And I started in this program, you know, my angel, she saved my life. This woman, Nancy, and she taught me that, you know, that I can't do this anymore. And she would say, once that switch is flipped, you can never flip it back. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And man, that sucked bad. Because I thought I'd never have fun. I would never be able to do anything again and enjoy it. Because my life was just engulfed with alcohol. Little did I know, you know, like Sandy Beach says, you know, you can change your past at any point in time. It was the best damn thing that's ever happened to me. The best thing. I end up in this this outpatient program, and actually, honestly, wanted help. And the last thing I wanted to do, and the reason why I went into the outpatient program is because I didn't want to come here and hang out with all you lunatics. And, you know, because, you know, I needed to, and that was the last thing that I wanted to do, and now I am very proud to be a part of this group. So I sign up for the program, start in the program, and find out that in order to stay in the program, you have to go to 3 AA meetings a week. And so I thought it was the worst thing ever, but I came in, it was a Monday, a noon meeting, and I came in, and I heard what I needed to hear. I heard exactly what I needed to hear. I got my last white chip. A friend of mine came in. I was a kid that I was living with in college who tried hitting me over the head with a frying pan. And he came in with me the same day because he had just been beaten up pretty good and had just lost his job and everything was terrible, so he wanted to fix it. And so he came in here that first day with me. I started coming every single day. Every single day. I couldn't get enough of it. It does for me now what drinking used to do for me, where if I have a long day at work and I'm stressed out, I come here. And when I leave, I get an even better feeling than those first couple drinks would have provided me with. And so, you know, I started coming here, and then it started becoming multiple times per day. And my buddy, who came in here with me, got a job after 5 days. Got a job, first night working, his boss offered him a beer. He said no. His coworkers ended up taking beers, and he's like, you know what, one's not going to hurt. Since then, he's been arrested, charged with 2 different things. He's moved 4 times. He's absolutely miserable. And you know what the amazing thing is? Is he's different because this doesn't work for him. That's what he said. You know, and the beautiful thing is, you know, it works if you work it. And I got a sponsor within the first week and a half or so because I was told by my angel Nancy that I needed to get a sponsor. And I wanted it. I yearned for relief. And got a sponsor, started meeting on a regular basis, every single Wednesday, Thursday before work. So, you know, every single Thursday, I'm right down the street with my sponsor, 7:30 in the morning. I am not a morning person. I hate getting up in the morning. Almost every Wednesday, I think to myself, man, maybe we can actually change it so that it's after work or something. But I'm realizing now that when those thoughts go through my mind, it's my alcoholism that is actually trying to get me to take my will back. It's like a prize fighter that throws the towel in and then string by string starts pulling that towel back. And I realize every time I go and meet with him, as tired and as terrible as I think it is to have to get up that early, every single time I finish and drive into work, I feel 1,000 times better than I did. You know, this program has provided me with so many miracles. My friends are all in the program now for the most part. You know, it's just I got myself centered in this thing. I was told, you know, by Nancy to get yourself centered in AA. Like during the noon meetings, we have the center section. I literally sat in the middle row of the center section because I wanted to get centered in it, and I wanted it so bad. Little did I know that's not what she was talking about. But you know, I was taking her literally. And you know, and the beautiful thing is that I realized I was just an emotional retard. I had no idea how to live life. I didn't. And when, you know, like people say, you know, my best thinking got me here. My best thinking earned me one of these chairs. You know, working the steps with my sponsor has been an absolute amazing, amazing experience. In the beginning, I wanted to speed it up. I wanted to get through this. I wanted to start working with other people. I wanted to jump ahead. I would read ahead. And, you know, and luckily for me, you know, my sponsor would be like, whoa, settle down. So it's one step at a time, one step at a time. And by working these steps, I am now able to take responsibility for myself. I am now able to intuitively be able to deal with situations that used to baffle me. And for that, I will always be grateful. This program has just been an absolute gift from God. It was a gift from God for me to hit the bottom. It was a gift from God for me to actually sit in that waiting room at South Seminole for like 4 or 5 hours, you know, like to actually not get up and leave like I was thinking I was going to. It was just all a gift from God. Everything here is a gift from God. It's amazing. And coming into these rooms, you know, being atheist, thinking that I could disprove the theory of God, you know, look at me, I'm so smart, you know, and not realizing that, you know, you don't have to believe in a higher power. You don't have to. That's why we have these 12 steps. These 12 steps, if you don't believe, you know, get a sponsor, work these 12 steps, and you're going to believe. If you don't, you know, then go back to it. If this thing can change my life, it can change anybody's life. You know, a few things that were given to me in the beginning of sobriety. One of the real big aha moments or turning points for me was in this outpatient group when. We met 3 times a week, and I remember it must have been like my second or third week or something like that. And Nancy had given us all this printout of this story, and I've heard people make references to it, like in different versions of it, the story of two dogs, the story of two wolves, the story of two whatever. When it was given to me, it was in a much longer, more detailed form, and it hit me. It hit me like a ton of bricks. When I heard it, it was absolutely amazing. And I, you know, it's a story of an old Cherokee teaching his grandson about life. A fight is going on inside of me, he says to the boy. It's a terrible fight. It's between two wolves. One is anger, envy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, and ego. The other is good. He is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith. The same fight is going on inside of you and every other man, too. So the grandson thinks about it for a little while. He asked his grandfather, well, which wolf will win? And the grandfather simply replies, the one you feed. And the reason why that hit me so hard is that my life was filled up with anger, with envy, with regret, with greed, with arrogance, with self-pity. And that's why it was me. It was just me. That was what my life was filled up with. And I drank to try to make that feel better and switch me over to the other side. And it didn't work. This program has brought me over to the other side. And today my life is peace, it's love, it's joy, it's empathy, it's benevolence. You know, and empathy and benevolence, those are two words I didn't even know what they meant when I read it the first time. And I actually wrote down the exact definition just so that I could say the exact definition. Empathy is in feeling the capacity to share another person's emotions and feelings. Benevolence, an act of or in general inclination towards charity. And those two words right there describe AA for me. Those two words. You guys have been nothing but kind and have been charitable. And you understand because every one of us has been there. Every single one of us. And, and the great things that I hear, the great things that I've learned over the short period of time that I'm here, you know, it's purely a gift from God. And, I guess my time's pretty much up. But one thing that I have heard that just when I heard it, it was another one of those like, whoa, like, holy crap. Heard a speaker once say, I sought my God I could not see. I sought my soul I could not free. I sought my brother and found all three. And that's what happened when I came here. Thank you for letting me share.